I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey guys, hey 99ers, are you guys willing to change your fan base name? Because we have a new podcast on Patreon, podcast like it's 1989, and we're looking to turn some of you 99ers into 89ers.
That's the hope, that you're interested in hearing us talk about some of the best films of 1989, from Batman to When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, Last Crusade, Field of Dreams, Major League, with great guests like Tom Meissen and Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Chuck Hayward, Brian Cogman. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For $5, you'll get access to audio for all of these fantastic episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 99 episodes as well as our 89 episodes. Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I'm your host, Phil Iskov, and with me today is David Iserson, writer, producer on New Girl, Mad Men, Mr. Robot, co-writer of The Spy Who Dumped Me, and he's here to talk to us today about episode 216, Was It Good For You? But before we get into this episode, David, I wanted to kind of get your thoughts on Sex and the City. Did Sure. you watch it back in the day? Did it come into your life later?
So I came to Sex and the City similar to The Sopranos, because I don't think I had HBO at the time. So I feel like I popped into both of those shows around like season three and season four, and then went back. So I think I had heard, you know, I knew of Sex and the City, but I was in college and I had no way of watching it. So I eventually saw it all, but probably not in its initial order. And I've like gone through the series, I don't know, maybe like a decade ago, but like when I watched this episode to talk about this, I hadn't seen a Sex and the City episode for some time.
So first of all, it should be said, you are our first straight male coming on this podcast for this show.
What about you, Phyllis?
you know what I mean. Other than the host, I want to kind of get that perspective a little bit as well, right? Which is that there is this unfortunate, or however you want to call it, this sort of idea that this show is only made for women and gay people is really kind of this moniker that the show lives under in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of guys would either watch this show with their girlfriends, or, you know, I guess my the reason I bring this up is I feel like to some degree or another, I'm a little bit of an anomaly. And I'm wondering whether or not you feel as though this show sort of speaks to straight men in the same way that it, you know, that it's
I mean, I'm gonna take the anomaly card. I do not think I speak for straight men as a monolith. I think that like my TV and film and book habits, and on also what I've worked on as a writer, I think the fact that I am straight is one of the very few straight things about me, about my tastes. So, you know, it's like, I can't say that. Famous Iserson story is that when my brother came out, my parents thought, we thought you were the gay one.
That's really funny. I guess the reason I asked the question is because I just feel like men are threatened by this show. And I think that part of that has to do with the fact that, you know, your four leads are all women. That for, you know, for being honest, for most of the first two seasons of this show, the men were punchlines. They were sort of this revolving door of boyfriends and stuff like that, that, you know, they weren't as substantive characters as the women were on the show. All of this is not an excuse, nor is it a reason why men should feel threatened by it. But do you think that there is something to that idea?
Well, it's interesting to think about how few television shows of this era or even films are like, feel like it at least had the sheen of being cool and being a part of culture, and it was not made for straight men at all. There was not a way in, you know. It's like, even you watch, even watching a romantic comedy, it's like there's a lot of sports scenes in My Best Friend's Wedding. There's just like a few things to be like, oh, well, the boyfriends, you got to give them something or else they're going to walk out, which is obviously not a thing that, that culture at this time did for women with stuff that was specifically made for men. But I think it was threatening because there may have just been something that was so, certainly there were many shows that were very much felt like they were marketed towards women, but not a show that like was on, you know, that was on this edgy network, and it had like sex in it and it had nudity in it. I mean, but it was not for straight men. So I think that was the very bold choice that they made. And I still think, I think that there is a way that this show is very, I think the show is slightly responsible for, as it went on and what it kind of became in its movies, that it is a little bit more, it was seen as a lot broader and more candy colored and a little bit less like, because this episode, like, I was just taken aback by how like gritty it felt, like film grain kind of gritty. But like, mm-hmm. I think people view what Sex and the City kind of became as what Sex and the City is. And so it just allowed straight men to also be like, oh, I was right for not liking that show. I was right for like dismissing that show.
For sure. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the ongoing sort of themes throughout this miniseries really has been how groundbreaking the show was at the time, and how perhaps not as groundbreaking it seems now, obviously. I mean, it's been 20 years and lots of things have changed. And one would argue that the movies, their tone deafness and their sort of not reading the room in terms of various things, has left, to your point, this kind of fallout or this kind of cloud over the entire show to some degree or another. I mean, who knows what this revival will look like? I'm curious. It could be any number of things, and we'll see when it airs, perhaps sometime by the end of this year. But, you know, I think that there's a depth to this show that I don't think a lot of people give credence to. I think it's easy to sort of dismiss this show based on the superficiality of it to some degree or another. And I also think that people, and I'm curious as to your thoughts on this too, which is sort of the comedy versus drama, the broadcast versus cable narrative as well, of that idea of, you know, that a half hour isn't as substantive as an hour.
Right.
You know, and I think this show grappled with that a little bit and broke some ground in terms of how deep and how kind of dark you could go. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think there was a lot more of a strong line between what was a half hour show and what was what was a drama and what was a comedy back then. I mean, I think there is, this still existed in a world where it was like contemporary to Ally McBeal which I recently rewatched that pilot, and you know, and so it did it did feel like it was like kind of part of a conversation of like of a show that like can kind of straddle a line between comedy and drama. I think Sex and the City ages a lot better than Ally McBeal does, but I think that it was very much like for a show that allowed itself to be, clearly was a comedy, was meant to be funny, had actual hard jokes, but I think that there was a viewpoint in a lot of comedy shows that like the success of a comedy show, if it was working, how many laughs it would get. And I don't know how many laughs this show would get at a table read. I mean, I imagine like Samantha lines are kind of meant for laughs, but it was, I think what I was struck by was also like how much story they were trying to jam in. And not even that there was like, we'll get into the plot of the episode, but like, it's like, there's very, very simple plot, but like that it hit many beats. And that felt, and had a lot of voiceover. And so that felt like there was absolutely, this story could have been told an hour, and like an HBO half hour is 30 minutes versus 22 and versus whatever 44. And so it really actually is, you know, in a world where most shows were network then, it somehow actually exists as a hybrid of length between comedy and drama. And so sort of told its story from that place.
Yeah. I mean, I absolutely agree with all of that. I think that, you know, what's interesting is, you know, right at the same time, these two shows are airing, you know, Friends has been on for a few seasons, and these are both sort of like quote unquote New York shows. One actually takes place in New York. The other one is shot in Burbank. You know, Friends has a very kind of idyllic, very obviously broadcasty way of looking at single life and what have you. And this show is, to your point, taking a grittier dive into it. I just think it's interesting that it does feel as though this show is clumped in with a lot of sort of lighter fare. And then you watch this episode and, you know, we'll get into the specifics of this episode in a minute, but I do think that it takes some swings. It goes to places that I think a lot of shows, certainly at the time, weren't. You know, you brought up The Sopranos, and I had Emily Nussbaum on for the first episode to talk about her New Yorker article, which tapped into sort of that idea of, you know, Sopranos premieres in 99, Sex and the City premiered in 98, but they're both sort of cresting at the same time. They're both sort of these anti-hero shows in very different ways. But like, Carrie is an anti-hero. She's a tough character to sort of, you love her because she's messy and fucked up. And that's very much unlike any sort of female character protagonist had been up until that point. Did you feel like, you know, you obviously have worked on numerous comedies and you've written lots of female leads, and, you know, watching this again, did you feel some sort of connective tissue between like a New Girl and a Sex and the City? Did you feel like?
No, I felt connective tissue between this and The Sopranos. I felt closer to that. I felt like the fact that Carrie is a messy character, but she is narrating it, that we get framed through her morality. I mean, this is not to like speak too much. I mean, New Girl is just like another New Girl, like it's New a, Girl and shows animal, like New Girl are a different animal. But like the thing that I think about when I think of like network sitcoms, and honestly, even a lot of, you know, prestige sitcoms that maybe weren't HBO prestige, like streamer or like Showtime shows or whatever, is still there is a real, there, there, it's like sex is still like a last taboo about people talking very, very frankly. Like people, I mean, I think it is very mainstream to talk about sexuality and sexual orientation and even maybe sexual desire to a degree, mm-hmm. but the actual sex acts and being able to joke about that, it still feels that was breaking so much ground then and still feels like it breaks ground now. Like I don't certainly see that on Darren Star or Michael Patrick King shows going forward of like that. And I can't really think of a show that, unless it's kind of doing it in a much more exploitative way, mm-hmm. I can't think of other shows that allow people to talk about sex in a way that actually, like, I don't recall my peer group doing at the time. I don't feel like,
right.
I feel like it was stating a thing that I don't know how many people were actually talking as frankly about. Like, I feel like it actually like led the, you know, led conversations rather than reflected conversations. But
I think that the show that I think shares some DNA with the show, they're very different tonally, but Girls is probably the only other show that I would sort of point at, also an HBO show, obviously another show about four young single people in New York. But, you know, Girls was very frank about sex in a mm-hmm. different way. This show is looking for, is trying to sort of let your freak flag fly and is sort of poking fun at and trying to kind of take the piss out of sex to some degree or another. I think that Girls is coming at it from a much more dramatic and perhaps more substantial perspective in terms of, you know, the emotional fallouts and the complexity and the trickiness that comes with being a certain age. I think they're very different shows, but that's the only other show that I would say. And again, it's not a show that's filled with laughs either. You know what I mean? Really?
No, it isn't. I mean, it does still have occasional, like, you know, like hard jokes
funny
in
moments,
it, but yeah, it's funny. I think of Girls a lot more like a grittier Friends than I do
yes.
like a younger Sex in the City. And I think, yeah. I think it's partially because I feel like the theme of Sex in the City, and this very much was the theme of this episode, was like, you know, it was a, you know, like a dissection and sort of a quest for good sex in, you know, like seeing sex, like trying to, that there was an idealized notion of like finding a good relationship, finding good sex. And that is why it is like the first word of the title.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas I think Girls is about, you know, just about fucked up people, and then sometimes fucked up people have fucked up sex.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think that, you know, this episode, which, well, first of all, I just sort of, did you feel like, so you said you watched this kind of in the, you know, vicinity of 1989 to some degree or another, a few years after probably,
mm-hmm.
and it's yeah. deeper in its run. But did you, you know, did you feel inspired by the show? I mean, you write a lot of female characters, and I'm sort of curious as to whether or not it had any sort of effect on you.
I think about it like a lot of my early writing was a like trying to figure out a balance of how much memoir you mm-hmm. want to do, how it's like how internal you want your character to be, how much you want to be in somebody's head. And I think there was sort of like a lot of debate amongst fledgling writers when I started writing about the use of voiceover and how to not overdo voiceover. And, you know, and I think Sex and the City is an extreme and does it well, and it is not a criticism of it, but it feels like probably the thing that I was taking for it as instructive was how sort of the balance between what a TV script is and what a piece of prose is. And I mm-hmm. probably never wrote anything as prosy in my writing as Sex and the City is. And then as far as like the stories and the characters and all that, it's like some of Sex and the City felt like it was meant to feel very real. And, it still doesn't feel, there's something that lacks a grounding in whether I would actually believe in these friendships. Do I believe that these people know each other? And for that, I think that it was probably more instructive as like a desire to probably build relationships between people that felt more organic than I think Sex and the City did.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, for me personally, I'm not a comedy writer, and I haven't really written in a half hour space. But you know, it was a show that I've rewatched many times over. I saw it, you know, around the time probably that it was airing. I mean, in Canada, it's a whole thing, so mostly it was the box sets once they came out on DVD. But you know, I remember it just it weirdly had an imprint on me, and I do think that that whenever I'm writing a funny female character on some level or another, I'm thinking about these characters. And I think that that's a testament to very well drawn, very well performed characters that just feel so defined. I mean, it's a cliche now in terms of women that are like, which one are you? Are you a Carrie? Are you a Miranda? Whatever. But like, I think that speaks volumes to the fact that the show really sort of, and I guess Friends did this too, of just kind of really nailing different types of people in a way that felt specific but universal, which is
yeah. Fun. Yes, I mean it's they are. God, I remember something that I've been like I've searched for this for so long to find the exact wording, but it was a something I read many, many years ago about a group of four in writing and how like so often different, you know, like a successful foursome will, you know, all sort of like fall into these different character types. So you can like probably map the Sex and the City archetypes onto Seinfeld, onto the Beatles, and I'm sure other four group people. But like, but yes, and I think it's also a thing that people did amongst our friend groups at the time, like in the late, like I do remember thinking about in my friend group, like who you were. I mean, I think I remember it much more distinctly thinking about who you were in Seinfeld than who you are in Sex and the City. But I think it also take like, you know, I think more in a Seinfeld world, people like to think of themselves the center of their own universe. So would probably tend to think of themselves the Jerry, where I think that even though Carrie is very much the star of the show, I think the balance of those stories were such, and those characters were so distinct that I think everyone could place themselves in one 100%. Of those archetypes.
You know, I'm going to give a very brief synopsis of the episode that we're talking about today. Carrie dates a recovering alcoholic who becomes obsessed with her. Charlotte's determined to learn how to have good sex after her latest partner falls asleep on her and drags the girls to a tantric sex class. Samantha gets an offer to have a threesome with two curious gay friends. Was It Good For You aired on September 19th, 1999. It was written by Michael Patrick King and directed by Dan Algrant. Vulture put it at number 73 of 96 episodes. So they didn't they call that highly of it. You know, I from 30,000 feet, the things that jumped out at me a little bit, and I'm curious about your thoughts on this too. So this is episode 16 of 18. There are two more episodes to come after it. As I'm sure you know, you're well acquainted. Your penultimate and your ultimate episodes or season finales, you're generally, you know, what you're aiming for, right? That's a thing that you're, this felt a little bit like a treading water episode.
Your third to last episodes are almost always duds because, well, they are because you're like, you are, you know, there's a school of thought, like there's the Soprano school of thought where like you do all your big moves in the penultimate or you do all your big moves in the finale, but like you are focused on those two and you do need, you know, this isn't a serialized show in the way that you need to set up a bunch of things for the finale, but it does feel like, you know, those are, you're spending time constructing your season ender and these will get, there's something that felt very much like they were pulling some extra stories off of the board. I don't know, because I haven't rewatched in a while, like, was it unusual for like one of them not to get a story because there was no Miranda story. Yeah.
Very unusual for that to happen. Generally speaking, they all get their own storyline.
Right.
So, you know, Miranda's gets new sheets is kind of a...
Yeah, and then Carrie's story was kind of... It felt like a little bit of two stories jammed into each other. Mm-hmm. And then like, it feels a very big deal that Charlotte is reckoning with whether or not she's good at sex, and that almost it doesn't have a lot of beats to it. It's like they actually just burned a couple of good stories, and you know, and like Samantha, yeah, it's like it's it, there. There was no very little setup with Samantha's story either. So it really did feel like a grab bag of like, we pitched these things. They've been like cut from other episodes, perhaps.
I want to sort of go at each storyline just to kind of break it down. I mean, the Miranda thing isn't a storyline. Miranda buys new sheets and she's trying to create good karma for her bed. That's really her storyline, which is
and then she gets a lot of jokes in the sex class.
I think
that they compensate it for it by giving her a lot of comedy moments.
Well, it's really funny what you just said, because I really do think that it is a grab bag. It's like, they're like, well, they should go to a tantric sex class. Like, someone pitched that in the room and they're like, that's good. Put that up on the board, right?
Yeah.
So it goes on, and I'm sure this is with your rooms too, where like you have a list of ideas, right? Just mm-hmm. and every now and then you go to that list when you guys are hard up for ideas, basically. So, you know, a tantric class, sure. Samantha has some gay friends that want to have sex with her. Okay, sure. Like, there's just things that kind of, you know, Charlotte's boyfriend falls asleep on her while he's having sex. All of these things feel like ideas that are not completely fully fleshed out. The only fleshed out storyline really is Carrie's storyline. It's the only one that really has...
Lost you.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now?
I lost you. I can hear you now. Yeah.
Okay. It really feels like the only storyline that was really fully fleshed out was Carrie's.
Yeah.
Everybody else sort of had like funny beats, funny moments. And I do think that, you know, when you're, and again, I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, but when you get to episode 16 of 18, you know, there's not much gas left in the tank. You're all pretty fucking burnt out. Everyone, you know, all the upper levels are all focused on the last two episodes. So you tend to have sort of this like, kind of weirdo episode, and this does feel that way. On top of all of that, we're also in a string of episodes where, you know, Carrie and Big break up about two or three episodes before this. So we're in this stretch of episodes where like Carrie's single and dating again, but lying on the horizon is the revelation in the next episode that Big is engaged to some woman that he met in Paris. And it's sort of like the gut punch of the end of this season is what's Carrie going to do in a bigless world, quote unquote, as we go into season three. So this episode feels a little bit like, I mean, is Carrie really wondering if she's good in bed? Like, I mean, I think it's a safe assessment that she's probably pretty good at this point, but it's just like, it does feel a little half baked overall.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also felt, it was also like, very, and this might just be endemic of like second season and the show isn't a phenomenon, but it's like the guest stars are very forgettable. It feels very like it feels a little like there was almost no, I mean, Charlotte saying I signed up for a tantric sex class and I signed you all up too, mm-hmm. is real sitcom-y and really doesn't feel like this show. It just, it's like you can find a few beats of justification to, mm-hmm. to like, you know, you could, you know, ideally you would make a scene where Charlotte is embarrassed as she's signing up or something, because that just felt, and the fact that they all go just felt way more TV than the rest of the
I completely agree with you.
Show does.
It's, you know, it's, On the Charlotte storyline, which, if we're being honest, the Charlotte storyline actually kind of pulls everything into it in a weird way. It kind of becomes the connective tissue to a lot of these storylines because the tantric sex kind of pulls them all into that space. But she's dating this surgeon who has had, you know, he's been working all night and he's tired and he falls asleep while having sex with her, and it spins her out and she starts to fear that she's no good at sex. So she decides, you know, as we've discussed, to sign them up for this tantric class. Samantha isn't surprised that it happened to Charlotte, which I think is kind of amazing.
Right. Yes.
The tantric sex class is very funny. I mean, mm-hmm. it's broad and it's a little bit of like low hanging fruit in terms of, I mean, Miranda getting shot in the face with semen. These are all things that you're just sort of like, that feel a little bit too broad for this show. Even
the prop guy who has never seen semen before.
Like, that too.
Is yeah. this semen?
Is it suntan lotion? I don't know. Yeah, it's definitely but the scene itself is funny. Mm-hmm. I was almost surprised that we hadn't been to some sort of a sex class before this at this
right.
point. Like,
yeah.
We're about the 40 episodes almost into this show, so I'm a little surprised we hadn't done this yet.
It is wild that a show in its second season on HBO is that deep in. I mean, it's yeah. just that's of a just another time. Yeah.
yeah. But you have this I want to assume an Eastern European woman who's running this class in some form or another. She brings her husband out in order to do some sort of a massage to show the class. And, you know, Miranda in this scene very much feels like the snarky kid in class.
Yeah.
Like it's just like it's one crack after another that's making
very, very disrespectful to the woman, to the woman and her husband. I wonder when it was written if everyone thought everyone was going to be in such, I guess they did think they were going to be in such proximity together because she gets semen in her hair. So yeah. it's like, but the way it was shot, it was like, it was very jarring of like, how mean that was.
It's literally, I mean, the man is, as you can imagine, no more than 3 or 4 feet away from
yeah,
her.
Yeah.
And she's just mocking him relentlessly while he gets basically a hand job from his wife in front of everybody. It does have, ultimately, the line is funny, but it's, I mean, Cynthia Nixon's delivery of perineum, Latin for not without an engagement ring,
yeah.
is fantastic. I mean, this comes back to sort of what I was saying earlier about how this show's funny on the page, don't get me wrong, but the execution of this stuff, you can't give enough credit to these four actors and what they're bringing to it.
Right.
And making it feel lived in and making it feel funny. But yeah, so this class happens, the guy ejaculates in her hair. It's a funny scene, but it's also a little bit of a like...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It almost feels like meanwhile on a different television show in a weird way. Like it doesn't necessarily
it not only does that. So it also is like Miranda's jokes are funny, but they're also not quite her voice. Like it felt like, yeah, I mean, it's a great delivery of the line, not without an engagement ring. That doesn't actually feel like that's her character. I thought about this when it was announced that, Kim Cattrall's not in the remake or in the reboot is that like the Samantha character is very much a character that exists in a lot of sitcoms, which is the writer's surrogate. It's what, you know, what Schmidt was on New Girl. It's what Kramer. Chandler is on Friends. No, not Kramer. No, I'm saying someone who actually can say very written comedy writer lines. Mm-hmm. Kramer's the all physical. So yeah, right. So it's somebody who actually is like just Sasha Mamet on Girls. Character that doesn't quite exist in reality, but is speaking like a writer's room. And so for this scene, I'm like, okay, they're giving, you know, so I'm worried about the reboot because it doesn't have Samantha who gets to say all these very written lines, but you know, this is them giving those to Miranda. Whereas like Charlotte can't have those lines.
I fully agree with you. And I want to get your thoughts on the revival at the end when we wrap this up, but I would agree with you that part of what makes this show work is the four of them. And right. It's not just the importance that Samantha has as a character in terms of the dynamics and in terms of the universe, but in terms of the balance is sort of what you're getting at, right? Which is that idea of what sort of what boxes this character checks is really important. But so speaking of Samantha, she's invited into a threesome by two of her gay friends. They want to finally have sex with a woman. Samantha has a line where she says soon everyone will be pansexual, and she's not necessarily wrong. It does feel
I do want to talk about that line. I wrote it down. It was very striking because it was about, you know, because it was speaking to our world right now. So she says she says the new millennium will not be about sexual labels. It will be about sexual expression. And when that happened, when she said it, I'm like, wow, profound. And then I thought about it. And I was like, oh, well, actually, like, that's not true. It's true at the time that she believed it. But for a moment, I thought it was profound. And then I was like, oh, no, it's like in the way that we were talking before, that there still feels a little bit taboo for I'm not speaking for all people, but it feels like when I'm talking about public discourse, for people to specifically talk about sex acts that they engage in, though. But I feel people are more comfortable being able to define themselves in ways that like perhaps they were not in 1999. But like the idea that like nobody is actually caring about how they're identifying and what they're being labeled, merely about what it is that they're doing. I think like, yeah, while it sounded like extremely prescient when she said it, I was like, the reality is it doesn't feel like it's true at all. Yeah.
I mean, I think we have a lot more labels now, which is not necessarily a good thing.
Which is not what Samantha wanted.
I think what you're tapping into and what I tapped into as well in this moment before, you know, we'll continue on the storyline and it obviously doesn't go the way that she wants it to. But I do think that it does speak to the open-mindedness of Samantha's character.
For sure.
This idea of this freedom that she believes that she has, which quite frankly, she does sort of have, but then, you know, kind of eats her words a little bit later. But I think that there's something very progressive about it. And in that moment, I imagine when this episode airs, you know, it that might have felt like a really big thing for a character say. In this rewatch, I found myself, Samantha's character, I think, might arguably be the hardest character for them to write on the show. She's much more of a high wire act than I feel like any of the other characters are. In terms of not making her a caricature, making sure she doesn't ever tip into that place of feeling like a cartoon character of just this like naughty sex crazed lunatic. But also at times they tip her in the other direction where she becomes a little bit too emotionally involved in things and becomes a little too, I don't want to say fragile, but just sort of emotionally, you know, fragile. So there's something there that I think is really interesting on Samantha's character. And I feel like the series does a great job with her. The movies don't do a particularly good job. I don't begin to know why Kim Cattrall doesn't want to be on the show anymore. That's obviously drama that's far outside my purview. But the show will be lesser for her not being on it. And I think that she speaks for a very interesting group of people.
I think there was something really striking about the choice to make her to build a character into this group of four who is older. Yes. And I was thinking about thinking about if this show existed today, new, and you were casting it, that does feel like a bold, smart choice that not a lot of shows do. That does not exist on Girls. It doesn't exist on Friends, New Girls, Seinfeld, whatever. So there is something about that, something about somebody being both their friend and being wise in some ways, and then allowing her to be a little bit of a Statler and Waldorf character in other ways, being able to, stand on the sidelines and comment on everybody. I think it was interesting that they were able to try to find depth for her, try to give her pathos, try to make her more well-rounded. And I think there is something that it does that will feel lesser because there is something about, there was something about the world that she was able to see, it's interesting because then everyone in the reboot will be older than Samantha is, in these episodes by a lot. So everyone will be not experiencing the world as if the world is built for them as they do right now. But correct. Still, there's a lot that Samantha being, being in a different place in her life and experiencing different things. And it does feel like I'm sure they will build out somebody, some other side character or something.
I'm assuming there will be either, Stanford's character will get built out or any number of other people can perhaps fill some of the, that sort of vacuum that she's going to leave. But Samantha's character decides she has a little bit of she's a little nervous about having this threesome, but she goes through with it anyway. The Davids are all into it until they get basically to her genitals. And then they're like, we're good. We don't need this. And she feels a little rejected by it, which is what kind of motivates her to go into this tantric sex class, which to your point also feels a little bit not Samantha. Like, I don't necessarily know that she would care particularly. So she's a little meek in the tantric sex scene when I imagine it would be the other way around. And I think this speaks to what you're talking about, which is we'll give Miranda a bunch of jokes in the tantric scene so it won't feel as though she didn't really do anything in this episode. But to your point, it's odd and it doesn't totally work. And then ultimately Samantha's storyline just wraps itself up and that's it. She goes to there's no wrap up on the character. We never check back in with her.
No, it really felt that she was going to, it really felt like there was going to be a turn tantric sex class. And there wasn't. Yeah.
So let's get into the sort of the meat of the episode, which is the Carrie storyline, which is, she meets this guy, Patrick, basically he's just standing on the street smoking a cigarette and he flicks the cigarette and it hits her and it's a lame me cute. I mean, I don't know how you felt about it, but it didn't really
I think the only thing that was super jarring was seeing smoking in that way. She was smoking in the scene before too. I don't know if that was
lot on the show,
but it was her referencing being the last smoker in New York and then how into smoking they were, but no, it was a bad meet cute. And it was, but he also was kind of a dud of a guy. Like it just,
it's interesting. The previous episode was, Shortcomings, which is the Justin Theroux episode where he suffers from premature ejaculation and his mother is Valerie Harper. And you're just like, you've got these two just like 1-2 punch of great guest actors for this episode. And then you come into this one and you're like, who's this guy? Like this guy just, he doesn't register really anything. He's really kind of, and I don't mean to rag on the guy, but it's just to your point, guest actors are so important on this show in particular in these first couple seasons where you have a revolving door of characters and you've got to make sure that they pop. And obviously the litany of people that have been on Sex and the City from Will Arnett to Justin Theroux to you know, Bradley Cooper had his first acting gig in an episode from the second season of Sex and the City. So like it was a real breeding ground of amazing actors. This guy just sort of, he's a film composer. He seems a little bit nervous around her. We don't really get why. This is also the part of the storyline that I think they kind of bungle, which is she doesn't get why he's not calling her back. They exchange phone numbers. They hang out a bit, but something seems off. And they drag the something feels off a little too long as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
So then when the reveal happens, which is that he's an alcoholic and he's been smoking outside his AA meetings, happens, it's jarring. Like it's just a very weird tonal thing in the storyline that just doesn't totally work for me.
It's a very, yeah. I mean, it's, yeah. And that's where it sort of feels like there are a few stories jammed in with each other. Cause there is, they build out this mystery and it's quite, and they build it out in quite a few places of like, you know, it's why isn't he calling you back? And then they keep having these dates, and it's like this episode is clearly covering a very long time. But when the reveal had, because you see him on, she sees him on the street, you know, after he doesn't call her back, and you know, he's very uncomfortable seeing her, and there are so many answers to why that could be. I think she speculates that he was with his boyfriend. There was a lot of things that it could be, and it did feel like standing outside an AA meeting was very unsatisfying, and it was not, you know, if the story existed, if they weren't building that out as a mystery, she knew she met this guy standing outside his AA meeting, and you know, and you establish the rules very early, like part of AA is I can't be in a relationship for a year, then you have that tension going through it. But this thing, they're really, for multiple scenes, building out a question that when they answer it feels odd and off.
Yeah, it's, I agree with all of that. It's, I also think, if I'm being completely frank, and I don't mean to be overly sensitive, but alcoholism's not really like funny. Like it's kind of dark subject matter, and this character is grappling with some pretty dark things. And you know, he doesn't want to kiss Carrie. They go on several dates. She doesn't get it. Why doesn't he want to kiss me? Why doesn't he want to kiss me? And then he explains to her that he's never had sex sober, basically, and he just doesn't really know if he's going to be any good at it. That's a pretty heady issue, right? Like that there's some deep stuff going on there. And I'm not saying that they don't want to talk about it at all, but they don't want to talk about it much. And they really want to kind of mine it more for the jokes than they, which is, again, it's a comedy and I get that. But I just found myself just feeling like, A, I did wish that there was a better actor that could sort of really kind of get a little bit more into this. Because I felt for the guy on a purely like intellectual level. I didn't necessarily feel for him on an emotional level because A, Carrie's making VO jokes about the guy, and B, this guy's just, you know, not really bringing it. So it's just like, it's,
yeah. You know, yeah. I mean, it's, I think that, yes, I agree that alcoholism isn't funny, but I do think that there's things to have explored with it. And instead they kind of explore nothing. Yeah. Like there is the possibility of scenes where he is trying to unburden himself from living a life that is very different than hers. Like having gone through stuff, having really experienced like a big rock bottom in his life, and Carrie, like, you know, having to be emotionally, like there's a big moment in the episode for Carrie in which she, you know, gives him her phone number, which she never does, which I just didn't buy the emotional stakes that. But if that was setting up a point where she is allowing herself to be more, put herself in a more vulnerable position, and you ride that out a little bit more, like that she, you know, takes on a certain codependency or something. I don't know. There was something that it was less that they played his alcoholism for laughs than that they just played it as a plot point. And it in every direction they could have gone would have been more interesting than kind of just having that kind of be just this line, you know, just this like cardboard cutout of a feature of a person.
There's also, yeah, I 100%. I agree with, on all of that. There's just, there's kind of this, there's this moment where they meet outside the AA class and he says to her, you know, I'm 3 weeks away from.
It's not a class, Phil.
You know what I mean? Sorry, AA meeting. My apologies. They meet outside the AA meeting and he says, I'm like 3 weeks away from getting something or crossing some sort of a threshold. And once I do that, then I'll feel more comfortable. And he's like, fuck it, let's just go out on a date. And I'd be like, this is a red flag.
Yes.
Like, this guy is saying, I'm not ready yet. And Carrie's like, no, 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 I'm going to push this guy into going out with me. It's just like, what do you expect? Yeah.
But you don't understand. I gave you my phone number. Yes. I'm Carrie Bradshaw. Yeah. I smoke cigarettes. You smoke cigarettes.
There's also, so they have sex eventually. And I gotta ask you, because, I mean, again, you're more obviously attuned to the comedic world than I am. They have sex, and then he's thrilled. He's like, this was amazing. I can't believe how great this was. And he starts jumping on her bed, and the scene just plays very strangely. It's not funny. It's kind of weird. It's mostly on him, because it seems like Sarah Jessica Parker, from a blocking perspective, is literally like hidden the whole time, and you can't even really see her reactions to anything until he eventually sits down and it becomes a two-shot again. But it's just, it's oddly blocked. It's oddly laid out. The weight of the scene, or at least the jokes or whatever, are on this guy's shoulders, which unfortunately he doesn't really execute. So the whole scene just feels kind of weird and sad to me, but maybe I'm reading too much.
Yeah. I mean, there's, yes, it is weird and sad. There's a lot of, it's a little bit of the actor, but I'm also trying to figure out what he could have done in a different way. I mean, I think there is, you're setting up some stakes of I've never had sex sober before. And there's, I mean, I think, comedically, you know, there's a version where like this rugged experience guy at life is completely baffled by everything. Mm-hmm. But the sort of jumping up for joy stuff, which is just, I mean, he has to know it's embarrassing too. It just doesn't feel, it immediately feels like a very adolescent view of even what sex is from the writing perspective.
Yeah, he feels like he's been on another planet for the past, like, you know, 20 some odd years. It's very strange. The storyline ultimately wraps itself up where Patrick tells Carrie that he loves her a week and a half into the relationship, to which she obviously is like, this seems crazy. We should maybe take a break. You should go to a class. And then he shows up at her apartment in the middle of the night drunk, strips in the street and starts screaming about how much he loves her and that it was the best sex he's ever had, blah blah blah. I just don't,
because he's now addicted to
he's
her.
Addicted
he's
to
replaced
Carrie.
His addictions
sure.
with Carrie.
Yeah. And then through VO we were told by Carrie that he went back to his AA meetings and he's back on the wagon and blah blah blah. I guess I'm just sort of unclear as to what this episode of television is trying to tell us about alcoholism. None of it seems particularly insightful to me.
None of it's insightful. They, you know, it's like, it's like one of those things where I've got to imagine a room full of comedy writers. Somebody has to know what an AA meeting is like, but it did seem like they cribbed it from other TV shows where you know that writing amends is a thing that also happened on Seinfeld. So you're like, there's a thing, but there was something that felt very, you know, it felt very false, you know, felt false the whole episode. So it was tricky. And it's also like, I mean, It gives you some indication of things Carrie could, you know, like stuff on, because I'll say Big Sir sure seems like an alcoholic, and Carrie's relationship with him is very addictive, like Al-Anon-y. And so there is like stuff there's so much more that could have been explored there, and just in. It's not that it's cheap that I care about it. It's that it's just like, it's nothing. It's almost like you burned the storyline for no reason.
Yep. No, I would agree. It's a hodgepodgey episode that feels like it's trying to kind of do a bunch of stuff. And by that, I mean, kick the can down the road until we get to the penultimate and the finale of the season. And it feels a little placeholdery. you know, a lot of sort of stuff that you're just like, yeah, sure. I mean, this will work. there's this weird factoid that I found out about this episode that I'll read. In 2007, the episode was in the news for being part of research conducted by Ellie Parker and Adrian Fernman of the Department of Psychology at the University College of London. In a study released online in advance of its publication in Applied Cognitive Psychology, Parker and Fernman investigated an audience's ability to recall advertisements under varying circumstances. It compared advertisements placed in Was It Good For You versus those placed in an episode of Malcolm in the Middle. The researchers discovered that programs heavy on sexual content actually lead to less recall of ads than appearing in commercial breaks, and that sex was an effective tool for selling.
They weren't saying there was product placement. They were saying they were literally putting commercials in there. Oh, correct. Interesting. Yeah.
Okay. And they realized that sex is an effective tool for selling to men. I don't think you needed a study to realize that, yes, but yes. I appreciate the
though there's no titillating sex for straight men in that episode, you know. So it's conversant about sex.
So I want to get your thoughts on the revival real quick before we wrap this up. You know, I want to get your thoughts on specifically this revival, but I also want to get your thoughts as someone who works in television on revivals. And how you feel about burgeoning IP, you know, obviously obsessed industry that we work in. But it does feel like we've had a lot of revivals over the last 5 years or so, I'll just say. And I'm curious as to what you think about it.
I think it sucks. I mean, it makes me think about how groundbreaking a show like this was when it came out to be about women in their 20s and their 30s talking about sex, and that this is now sort of like taking a slot from a show from like that. It's a very odd time right now just to be working in film or television because of like being in the sort of like age demographic of like mid 30s to mid 40s. It feels like that like executives are that age and that is who they're like, remember this. And yep. It's frustrating from a perspective of somebody trying to like come up with new ideas and pitch new ideas. Cause if you can't, coming up with something great isn't enough. Coming up with something original isn't enough. It's like you ideally want to find something, some way to spin a thing that already exists, but it's also that, and I think this is where the movies for Sex and the City got into trouble. And I think, but I mean, trouble is such a relative term. Yeah. I'm sure they're massive successes, but like it's fan service, and we as audience think we want fan service. We think we want what we want, but there's a reason that, you know, but it keeps us from being surprised. Like, you know, you a fan of Sex and the City think what you want is for Big and Carrie to get married, but like that's not what the show is, and they shouldn't be. And so that is just like a very, and I know like he's not going to be in the reboot, and so like mm-hmm. that, but that's probably more about contracts than anything else. But it's like, but it's this sort of belief that, that there is a desire to like that we're playing with action figures, and then we're just jumping to the fun candy parts of things. And that to me is, it's just, it feels very corporate and callous and like selling breakfast cereal aspect of what we do.
I'm in full agreement with you. I guess the question that I ask myself when stuff like this is announced is, you know, who is it for and why are we doing it? And I think that, you know, as a fan of this show, as a fan of many shows, I mean, there's a part of me that very much wants an Aaron Sorkin written series finale for The West Wing. I know that I want that, but I also know that show's been off the air for quite some time. You're going to have to go through, twist yourself into pretzels in order to get yourself to a place where you're back to zero again, where you can then hopefully be able to, it's just not worth it in the greater scheme of things. I mean, I know that there were a lot of Gilmore Girls fans that were really excited to have Amy Sherman-Palladino write that revival for Netflix and to sort of do that. proper quote unquote ending to to a beloved show. I understand the desire to want that. But we also sometimes need to be left wanting. And I know that from a corporate perspective, that's antithetical to everything that they believe in. But like,
yeah,
sometimes that's what's best for the show.
Yeah. And it's like, I love Gilmore Girls. I accepted that Gilmore Girls petered out, like most TV shows petered out.
Sure.
But I liked the reboot less than I liked the Amy Sherman Palladino-less seasons of Gilmore Girls because they were trying to, because they were just trying to hit all the, like, just hit all of these things. Like, I didn't enjoy that show because I, you know, you think about, it's like you watch old episodes of Happy Days and Seinfeld, and like when Fonzie comes in, the huge applause comes from the audience. Like, I don't need to watch TV like that. I don't need to have the, oh my God, it's them moment. I think about Friends as probably being the one sort of show that probably won't get rebooted because of various complicated, depressing reasons. But like, yeah,
this unscripted thing they've been trying to do. They can't seem to get
but
that.
Boy, out. Would I hate that show. Like, boy, would I not want to see 55-year-old Friends. Yeah. I mean, boy, do I not want to see that. Yeah. But that they're giving everything, they're giving us everything else. And it's not great.
It's not great. I mean, I you speaking of corporate stuff does make my brain go to this place of, I think there's a reason why this revival is on HBO Max and it is not going to be on HBO proper. I think that the hope being to pull people over to HBO Max, you know, is this a cash grab? I hope not. I hope that they have something legitimate to say. There's a part of me in my head that believes that perhaps there's a version of this revival being about what it's like being a single woman over 50 in New York City. If that's the story they want to tell, I think there might be an interesting show in that. I think that there were rumors that the third movie, which never happened, was going to be about Big after he died of a heart attack, and it was going to be about Carrie dealing with the fallout of that. This all seems like pretty heavy stuff as far as I'm concerned, but if they're genuinely interested in finding laughs and finding humor and solace in that universe, I'm all for it. But if they think that I want to see a threesome, the three of them just kind of doing the same antics again, I think they're wrong. But I mean,
it all feels like the Uber Eats Wayne's World commercial.
Yes.
Where it's like, yes. I remember when Wayne's World like reunited for like the SNL like 40th anniversary, and it's like, oh, I wish that it was a sketch about what it's like to be older and still be like Wayne. But it wasn't. It was as they were trying to pretend it happened 7 minutes after the last Wayne's World sketch. And I get the impetus to doing that, but I would not mind the Sex and the City reboot that is a different tone, a different vibe. I mean, that is like, frankly, it's just about more about middle age and
mortality.
Yeah. But yeah. I question if that's going to hit
the fan base
and that is ultimately going to be allowed, yeah, or it's going to be a little bit more like dressing up in those old, we have to track what it is like to sort of live in this sort of like repressed adolescence of, yep, of like Carrie, who does not quite, you know, doesn't grow up.
I fully agree with you. I'm also in my head, speaking of revivals, there's a part of me as well that feels like, I don't know if you watched the second revival of X-Files that they did, they did two bouts of them. And anyway, in the second one, they planted two FBI characters into the show, one played by Lauren Ambrose, and I unfortunately don't remember the actor's name who played the male character. This was all a very obvious attempt at planting characters that they could in theory, right, make a television right. show off of. I will not be shocked to see a new group of young women on the Sex and the City revival in the hopes of being able to perhaps create some sort of a spin-off show as well.
Yeah.
So there's it's all very corporate. It's the antithesis of creativity and all of that. The Wayne's World thing did make me think of something, which is the other day I was looking up, of all things, old top 10 lists from Siskel and Ebert, and Gene Siskel had Wayne's World at number 7 on his best of 1992 list. And I was just like, good for Gene Siskel.
I buy it.
Well, I mean, I want to thank you for coming on and talking about all of this with me. I really do appreciate it. And obviously we look forward to having you back in the future.
Great.
One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeits1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Also, please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits. Thank you to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our artwork and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.